Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Monday Memos from Concordia Seminary. Undoubtedly, many of you in our radio audience think that during the summer months, there's very little activity on the seminary campus, but that's not the case. In fact, today and all this week, it's a beehive of activity. Beginning tomorrow morning, we will have the annual two-day alumni reunion. This year, an invitation has been extended to alumni who are observing their 10th anniversary, their 20th, 25th, 30th, 40th, 50th, 55th, 60th, 65th, and 70th. There was a time in the past when we stopped at the 50th, and everyone looked up to these men with a great deal of enthusiasm and exaltation, I guess one could say. However, with greater longevity, those celebrating their 50th anniversary are almost, but not quite, considered youngsters. And to prove my point, I've invited into our studio today a pastor from the 60th anniversary class. If you would see him, you certainly would not believe me that he has been in the ministry for 60 years. Before I introduce him, however, I'd like to tell you just a little bit about the program that's scheduled for these next 2 days. Beginning tomorrow morning at 10:30 a.m., Dr. Martin Hensky from our seminary faculty will speak about facing crises in the pastor's life program. This is a topic which sooner or later affects not only clergy, of course, but everyone. In the afternoon, there will be a bus tour of historic Lutheran sites in St. Louis. Then the following morning, on Wednesday, Mr. Earl Hake will speak about the stewardship of the Pastor's Life program. Again, a very worthwhile subject. And after he finishes, Pastor Ronald Lind, who certainly is familiar to many of you in the KFUO listening audience, will speak about the challenge of aging in the Pastor's Life program. So, even though you may not be in any of these anniversary classes, pastors are welcome to come in and to join in on these sessions. Now, getting back to our guest in the studio, I told you that if you would see him, you would not believe that he has been in the ministry for 60 years. Our guest is Dr. Herman A. Mayer from St. Louis, probably well known to many of you. Welcome, Dr. Mayer.
I'm happy to be here, although when you said also 65 and 70 anniversaries are still being observed, I'm delighted to know that if God grants grace, I may be with you again at some future date, too.
That's wonderful. I should mention that we do have, for the first time this year, someone coming from the 70th anniversary class, one individual, and I think two or three from the 65th anniversary class. So you're by no means at the top of the ladder. Dr. Mayer, how many of your classmates are coming for the reunion?
As far as I know, there will be between 5 or 6.
That's good.
Of the total group of 94, which graduated in 1919, 60 years ago, there are only 18 still here on earth. The others have already joined the church triumphant.
Well, I would say that even 18 is very good. How many of those are in the active ministry in the sense that you are? Do you happen to know?
I would say none are any more in the active ministry. I'm not in the active ministry either. I retired 13 years ago at various stages in various ways from various activities. I'm really a retired man.
Well, you may say that, but you have a little trouble convincing me. You do take charge of quite a few things at your congregation, don't you?
Yes, both in the congregation and then beyond the congregation, too.
Oh.
Several years ago, I was asked to serve the Lutheran or Protestant patients at a big Catholic hospital here in South St. Louis.
At
Mount St. Rose, if you're acquainted
with
that.
Yes, yes.
I have between 15 and 20 whom I visit once a week.
Oh, my.
And about 3 or 4 years ago, I was asked there by the Catholic chaplain whether I would not be interested to have an occasional service at the chapel, in their chapel. And so I'm now once a month a pastor serving our Lutheran patients. And I'm always surprised, instead of having many Lutheran patients of these 20 or 25 that happen to be there, I have more Catholic people who attend the service.
Is that right?
And I preach a general message to them, which they appreciate very much.
And you call this retirement?
That's retirement. And then I've taken on a few other things, because a retired person usually has a lot of time, so they think. And every once in a while, even Mrs. Silfro, who sits across the way from here, puts some assignments on me, and also Dr. Silfro, the curator of the Historical Institute, harnesses me for various activities, which I gladly accept.
Well, you must admit, we recognize a good man when we see him. Okay, Dr. Mayer, you...
I'm also on the committee. You mentioned Dr. Pastor Lynn before, that he would speak about the aging. I'm on two different committees for the aging also.
Oh, is that right?
The committee of Metro Mission on the aging, and then also a mutual ministry committee, which meets at Koch Hospital once a month.
I see.
So I have two other committee meetings every month.
Well, I won't ask you what your age is, because I know that that's not very polite. But with a little mathematics, I think it wouldn't be too hard to figure out. You were graduated from our seminary in 1919. What was it like to be a seminary student 60 years ago?
We were a smaller group, for one thing, although our class numbered 94. And in addition to that, the seminary had about 350 all told. And yet, I think we were more closely associated and affiliated with one another. For one thing, the folks came from the various colleges, and they were a very fine, closely knit group. My group came from Milwaukee. I think there were 32 of us at that time who came from Milwaukee, others who came from Fort Wayne. They then associated with their classmates. And then we usually elected what we called a primus omnium. That means one out of many. Who was more or less the president of the entire class.
Of the class or of the whole student body?
Of the whole student body. Of the whole student body. And we were pretty well a self-contained group and also a self-governing group. The president of the synod of the seminary at that time was Dr. Ludwig Fielbringer, the father of our Dr. Alfred Fielbringer. And I don't think he did much in the administration of the seminary students. That was handled entirely. Even the we handled even the food administration. And that was done by the student body. We elected somebody who would be in charge, be the buyer and so on. And a baker was hired and so on. All that was pretty well in the hands of the students at that time.
That's interesting. Now, this was all down at the Jefferson Avenue campus.
On Jefferson Avenue, the old seminary. And the old buildings, of course, were still standing at that time. Now we have only one of the buildings remaining, a rather newer building. I think it was erected around the turn of the century. And that contains the contained the three large classrooms and what we called Hogan's Alley.
Hogan's Alley? What was that?
A series of rooms which was occupied by students above the classroom. The classrooms were on first and second floor. There was also a faculty room there, and in addition to that, really everything was on the first floor was the dining hall and the kitchen, and the kitchenettes, the girls who served in the dining hall were all housed in the in that building. That is now property of Holy Cross Church and used for various activities.
And I believe that will be included on the tour on Wednesday afternoon, so they'll have a chance to see this.
We had at that time a kitchen force, and they served the family style, so that it's not like today where you pick up your tray.
What about the dormitory life? How many stayed
in? Five and six in a dorm, in one room. Some of them were large rooms, and we had a study room, and then a large dormitory for bedrooms, which housed as many as maybe 25 and 30 in one room, way up on top under the balcony.
You mean that many slept in one room?
In one room. These were large bedrooms.
Oh.
And you could hear the snoring once in a while.
I guess you got used to anything there.
And interesting to me is in the morning at about 6:30 or maybe 7 o'clock, I don't know the exact time anymore. I know it was very little time. We had a man who could not hear well, but he rang the bell.
Mm-hmm.
And he opened the door, and we could hear it when he started at one end of the building, and opened the door, and then this big cowbell.
Mm-hmm.
And he rang, and he four or five times, and then he went to the next room, and we could hear the ringing of the bell all through the building for almost 5 minutes.
I'll bet that went over real big first thing in the morning.
Yeah. By the way, he was also our night watchman.
Oh.
And he had been sitting at the gate, at the door, all night long. He usually came at about 10:30 or 11 o'clock, and the doors were supposed to be closed at 10, then we would have to pass him. He sat right next to the door, and we would have to sign the night book. And later on, we would have to explain why we came in so late at night. And one of the professors had the book, and he would then always probe us. And he also had the book for morning devotion. And we would also have to sign, we had one man who kept record of who attended and who did not attend morning devotion. And then we would have to give an account why we overslept. And most of them said, Verschlafen.
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 was that legitimate?
That was always a good excuse.
Oh. With all those bells ringing, it would hardly be an excuse, would think. Well, what was a typical day like? Now, you mentioned that it's 6:30 about you were awake.
We had very little time to get ready and to go to breakfast. And then, of course, we had to get our room, our beds made and our room cleaned up. And swept and so on, and get everything into nice shape, and then be at class. I don't recall whether it was 8 or 8:10, but it was our first class was early in the morning, too.
Uh-huh.
And that went right on through till noon.
Uh-huh.
And sometime in the morning, maybe at 10 o'clock or 9:15 or 9:30, we had a chapel
and
devotion.
Mm-hmm.
And that was usually conducted by one of the professors.
Uh-huh.
Very seldomly by the students. However, we always had the statue of Dr. C.F.W. Walter on the platform, and we students, in our foolishness, decided Walter heard enough from on his right ear, we'll have to put him on the other side so he can hear from his left ear also.
That's interesting. Didn't you have any classes in the afternoon? Did they end at noon?
Yes, we had some classes in the afternoon, but those were usually for special purposes, like preaching and homiletics.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be in the chapel then and preach a trial sermon and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that was usually criticized, not by the professor, but by the students.
Students,
the students were oftentimes harder in their criticism than the professor would have been.
Yeah, I imagine so. What about the curriculum and the professors? How many were on the faculty at that time?
Our faculty was very limited and very. We had only the basic courses. We did not have anything about evangelism and all these various other courses which we have today.
Mm-hmm.
I wish we would have had some of them. By trial and error, we worked ourselves into it in years after.
Mm-hmm.
And we had very little about congregational management. That was almost so antiquated that we had a book which was written by Dr. C.F.W. Walter on administration.
Oh.
Imagine that was written around 1850 and 1860, 100 years, at least 75 years before.
Yeah.
And we did not have Dr. Fritz's Pastoral Theology, which now also is already antiquated and very old.
Yeah.
So very little on that, but we did have a good deal of history. We had, of course, systematic theology, also practical exegesis and
mm-hmm.
so on.
So the department...
But very little on the practical side.
I see. Uh-huh. But the basic department, as we have them today...
They are still super in force at that time.
Uh-huh.
And our faculty was very small, as you know, and many of our professors taught only in German.
Oh?
Dr. Dow was practically the only English professor we had, and he was called in order to begin work in English.
I see.
And so Dr. Metzger and even Dr. Kleppner, who was an English professor. He also taught some classes in German. And he especially taught homiletics. And since most of our teaching was in German at that time, we were still very bilingual. Well, hardly bilingual, I would say, more German than English.
Well, by the time you graduated, were you able to preach both in German and English?
Yes, if we knew enough English, we could preach in English.
Did most of them know enough?
I would say most of them were at that time bilingual. But our instruction in, or even in education, Dr. Metzger had a course in education, catechetics, which was taught in German. And he had a little book prepared on how to conduct the classes for confirmation and also in catechetics in German.
What about formal graduation exercises or call day? Did you have anything like that?
The presidents of the church came together. How are we doing on time?
We're doing fine.
All right. The presidents came together usually around the end of April. I know several times it happened that it was on Ascension, or rather during the Ascension Day period, so that would be even in May, end of May.
You mean the district president?
The district president. And they would come, and all the calls were presented to the president of the seminary, which was Dr. Fielbring at that time. In fact, I don't want to be ridiculous or point to a peculiarity, but we called Dr. Fielbring the Holy Spirit, acting in behalf of the Holy Spirit, because he knew all the students. The other faculty members hardly knew the students, but Dr. Fielbringer knew us, and he was the one that recommended the places to which we should be assigned.
Well, how did he get to know each student?
He even invited students to his home.
Exactly.
And I know I was in his home a number of times. Of course, I was perhaps a little closer to him since Dr. Fielbringer was at one time pastor in Frankenmuth. And I came from Frankenmuth, my father was, and he was our guest in our home, repeatedly. But he also had a way of inviting students to his office, and then he would sit and talk to them. And since he was a little bit hard of hearing, the students would have to sit very close to him, and it was a very intimate and personal discussion.
Just to get to know you.
To get to know us, and to know our desires and our likes and dislikes, whether we were interested in a parish, in a city, or our temperament. I remember, for example, that we had two storm brothers. And one of the storms, he characterized him this way. He said, I know that he is a very, very sober and slow-moving person. I think he should be placed into this parish, which has a lot of difficulties, and he was to be assistant pastor. His brother would not be a good assistant pastor because he temperamentally he would not be so qualified. But this man, he would be very well qualified.
Isn't that interesting? I'm just amazed.
He knew the students, I would say, better, or perhaps the only one who knew the students. And so he was really the one that recommended students to the different places.
And then what happened?
The president, when they came together, they would then accept Dr. Fielbringer's recommendation and would appoint and assign students to their places.
And then what about a call day? Did you have a formal?
Yes, then we had a day in which we had a service it was not really a service. It was merely an announcement day, you might say. I remember we came together in the large classroom. By the way, the classrooms at that time housed between 100 and even 150 students. These large classrooms, sometimes there were two classes put together and the professors only lectured. There was no discussion back and forth. It would be a lecture series and we would take notes. We would then be called into this large classroom and we would then be told by Dr. Fielbringer where our places were to which we had been assigned. And of course we all rushed to the maps, to see where this place was.
Now, where was your first call?
My place was International Falls, Minnesota. I had never heard of the place. I knew nothing of it. But That was the place, and I found it on the map, too.
Uh-huh.
Way on the Canadian border
mm-hmm.
in Minnesota. And interesting, too, there were certain prescriptions, prohibitions even. I was told that, or rather it was said in the call letter, that the man who gets this call cannot be married for at least 2 years.
Oh, my.
And I was ready to become engaged. We were not permitted even to be engaged prior to accepting the call, prior
uh-huh.
to graduation.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to postpone it. And in those days, we still believed what the faculty said.
Mm-hmm.
And since this call was extended not to be married for 2 years, we believed it. We acted accordingly.
Wow. Well, how did you get to International Falls? And what sort of transportation did you have after you got there?
By the way, it's interesting, too, how different times are. There was no one here at the seminary who at that time had an automobile. Not a one.
Not a one.
No, automobiles were still very great luxury.
Yes.
Nobody.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, when I went to International Falls, it was, of course, by train.
Mm-hmm.
So I went there by train.
Mm-hmm.
And
but then after you got there, what did you...
Then I began to gather my people together, and they were... at that time, I had two places, one in Canada and one in International Falls. And then there were other places in the neighborhood where I was to do some mission work.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was assigned to three large counties, and the largest county in Minnesota is Cochise County, of which I then... had that county in which I lived, and in addition to that, Beltrami and another county to the west.
Well, how far were these places apart?
About 25, 30 miles in all directions.
And how did you get
and,
there?
I went there, first of all, on the train, the Canadian National, went in two directions, came through International Falls, it was on the Canadian side, and then another, the train going south towards Bemidji, and those, of course, are covered by train. But very soon, I found that I had to leave even the towns and go 5, 10, and 15 miles away from the towns to find other little communities. And there, I finally bought a bicycle, took the bicycle in the baggage car, and when I came to the place where I got off, at Sleeman's or at Harrisburg or wherever it may be, then I get on my bicycle. And on the back of the bicycle, I had a little carrier. I carried mm-hmm. hymn books with me. I carried my communion vessels and so on. And then we went out and did mission work.
Is that right? Well, that is really
and
interesting.
And by the end of the first year, I was really regularly scheduled to preach at about 10 or 12. Finally, the largest number that I had was 13 preaching places.
Wow.
The first year, I was also vacancy pastor. That's another reason. All the way in Port Arthur and Port William, and another little town by the name Moose Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the way back, I went to Winnipeg then, and back again on the other. Winnipeg was on the Canadian Pacific, and then from there, I went to my western stations on the Canadian National, which was Baudette
mm-hmm.
and Rainy River, so on, Sleeman,
mm-hmm.
all these places.
But for the most part, you took the train and then took your bicycle with you. That is just extremely interesting.
And in the wintertime, of course, I had to go by snowshoe and the skis.
By snowshoe? Now that, well, I'm not familiar with.
We had a lot of snow there.
Yeah.
Snowshoes are awfully tiresome. Oftentimes I'd walk as far as 15 and 20 miles. The longest I ever walked on one day was 30 miles. Well, you can't walk 30 miles on snowshoes.
No,
That's too tiresome. But skis, if there were trails, you could follow the ski trails all right.
So even in your day, you were... cross-country skiing, I guess.
Yes, more or less.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it up there, and after 2 years, we were permitted to get married, and three weeks out of the month, I would really be gone, and only one whole week that I would be at home.
Is that right?
And, but I also was home usually on Sundays.
Uh-huh.
And,
you mean after you had preached?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
My poor wife at that time, because she was alone so much.
Yes.
In a strange town.
Yes, yeah.
But we had wonderful people there, and she also got acquainted with some of the school teachers, public school teachers, and we even, many of them needed meals, and so she would serve them noonday meals.
Oh.
It helped to undergird the salary at that time was $55 a month, out of which we had to pay rent for our home.
Oh, wow.
$55 a month.
Oh.
Of course, the rent wasn't very high. I think it was around $15, but even that didn't leave very much money.
No.
Oh, by the way, that was my call at when I was called $55. When I was married, I got a raise of $5.
Well, I'm glad that your wife knew how to live on $5 a month. Dr. Mayer, I just wish that we could go on and on, but I see that our time has elapsed. I'm just wondering, I'd like to ask you one final question. You have been around a long time. You've seen a lot of different kinds of ministries and ministers. What do you feel is the greatest challenges? What are the greatest challenges of today's ministry?
Well, then you have to, after I left International Falls after 8 years, I went to an organized congregation in Bay City, Michigan. And there I learned many tricks of the trade, and I found that it is wonderful to be able to go out and to win people for the Lord through the congregation. And then before very long, I was called into the work of the Synod as a mission secretary.
That's right.
For that, I worked here in St. Louis for 20 years, and I saw the rest of the world pretty well. And in the meantime, however, I would say the thing that challenges us today is not merely that we are pastors of a congregation of a group of members, but that we challenge the congregation, because if I, as an individual, can serve the Lord by bringing in other people, how much more can we do when we have a congregation of 1,000, or let us say 300 or 200 individual members, that we set them all to work?
Yes.
And that's the challenge which is before us today, that we must get the congregation to do the work and not the pastor.
Yes, I think that's an excellent closing note for our program today. You have just heard Dr. Herman A. Mayer, a member of the 60th anniversary class at Concordia Seminary, speak to us this morning. Thank you so much, Dr. Mayer. We appreciate you taking time out to come and visit with us.
You know, they say that age becomes talkative. Maybe I talk too much on some of the things.
Not at all.
All right,
thank you again.
We have been listening to Monday Memos from Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, with your host, Mrs. Gladys Soflo.
Coming up next on KFUO Lutheran Radio is Monday Memo from Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, with your host, Mrs. Gladys Soflo.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Monday Memos from Concordia Seminary. In these programs, we try to acquaint you with the people at the seminary, and today is no exception. We have with us in the studio Mr. Merlin Schepmeyer and Mr. Robert Keeney. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I should mention that Mr. Keeney's voice probably is not new to you, since he is here at KFUO and has served as announcer and in several other capacities. We have chosen to interview these two men because they are special students on our campus. They're not the regular run-of-the-mill kind. You two are special because you're both in the colloquy program. But before we start talking about the colloquy program itself, let's talk about the two of you a little bit. Bob, tell us something about yourself. What brought you here to the seminary, and what did you do before you came to the seminary?
I was born and raised in the Northern Illinois District, the Chicago area. Graduated from River Forest, and into the teaching ministry, and then served as a principal for a number of years.
Where?
Principal was at Joliet, Illinois.
I see.
St. Peter's. I was there for 7 years. And then was privileged to be called into the newly developing ministry called Director of Christian Education.
Mm.
Went to the Indiana District, Northeastern Indiana, and served there for a few years, and then was called back into teaching ministry in the Atlanta, Georgia area, Marietta.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I was called most recently to a small congregation in Florida as their first director of Christian education in a unique situation in which the pastor was going to retire,
mm-hmm.
and they expected a long vacancy.
Mm-hmm.
They called me, and I felt the Lord moving me in that direction. I knew that I had the tools, I felt, to do the job that they were asking me to do, and I took it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've moved from the north to the south, and then about a year ago, through some friends and through, I'm sure, the Lord's urging and nudging and prodding, I began considering coming to the pastoral ministry in the Colloquy program.
Was this kind of the first time that you had that idea, or was it in the back of your mind before that?
It was definitely in the back of the mind. I can say for a number of years, probably 6 or 7 years before that decision was finally made, not only did I consider the possibility off and on, but people were continually challenging me, as usually after they had heard me preach a sermon in a vacation spot or one of those opportunities that would come up in which people would hear me put together some words, and they would always urge me to consider the pastoral ministry. I never really considered it seriously, though, until last year, when I felt, and my wife the same way, that perhaps maybe the Holy Spirit was saying, let's get busy with this wrestling match and get it over with. And it didn't take very long.
Now, you mentioned your wife. What does your family consist of?
I have a wife and two sons, Mark, who is 4 and a half, and Paul, who just turned 2.
I see.
My wife was a former director of Christian education, and I met her originally on this campus at an educator's conference.
Well, okay, so then what happened a year ago?
After we made our own decision, we felt we wanted to check it out with our district president, having already checked it out with the pastor, the new pastor of the congregation, who certainly encouraged me every step of the way. So we went to President Benkin in Florida, and there was not much left to be said, because President Benkin was most encouraging, and I would say very happy. I don't know whether he had something in mind before that or not, but he was most happy when he heard that I had made that decision, and gave us a good deal of help in working through the paperwork and securing the necessary documents that he then would have to forward to the seminary through the Colloquy Board downtown.
So then when did you arrive here on our campus?
The middle of August of last year.
Yes. I see. So you've been here almost a year now.
Yes.
Okay, well, before we continue with you, Merlin, I think we should turn to you. I think your background is quite different, totally different. Tell us something about it.
Gladys, I was raised in Collinsville, Illinois, so coming back to the seminary gets me pretty close to home. I traveled around the country quite a bit, working for various companies and organizations. I guess I spent my most time with Ford Motor Company, both in Dearborn, Michigan, and in Newport Beach, California. We've lived in Alabama, and we've lived in Tennessee, Nashville, for quite a number of years. But I've always had the feeling that this is what I wanted to do, and this is where I needed to be. Betty and I had even gotten to as far as Springfield once when the seminary was there, but for some reason or other, we decided that the time was not right, and so I didn't go any farther. But I'm here now. I started here last November in the winter quarter, and I'm sort of, I guess, at peace with myself, because this is where I think the Lord wants me, and I'm glad to be here.
Now, you are a Valpo graduate,
that's
that
right.
Correct?
That's right. I went to Valparaiso after World War II, and even then had the idea that maybe I ought to go on to Springfield, but I was so much in debt after trying to get through undergraduate school that I just had to go to get a job. And,
One question. Now, I don't want to be so bold as to ask your ages, but I'm sure that if you volunteer it, we won't mind.
I'm 39 and holding. Actually, I'm 53. But that has not been a deterrent at all.
It has not.
Not at all. I find that I'm well accepted by everyone. The faculty has been very supportive of my needs, and I think that they're seriously concerned and interested in helping us in every way that they can.
Very seriously, though, isn't it difficult to get back into the classroom after so many years and to knuckle down?
The hardest part for me is the memorization, getting the old brain to remember things. But it gets easier as you go along. And it's such a joy to be here that working the long hours, and they are long hours, I'm working harder now than I've ever worked in my life. But it's still a real joy, and it's a lot of fun, and they're new and exciting discoveries that come up every day, and I frankly think it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
I have to echo what Merlin has said. Incidentally, I'm much younger than Merlin. I'm 42.
Okay.
But I am very happy to be here. I have thanked the Lord many times over and over for the pleasure and the opportunity of being on this campus, of learning from the instructors, the professors who are here, and just from living in this atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So far as the study routines were concerned, I guess I did not find it too difficult to get back into harness the discipline that's necessary for this kind of study. The most difficult part, of course, is finding enough hours in the day to get all of the studying done and still be able to play with your children
once
in a while.
And that's, speaking now as a wife and mother, how do wives and children react when this decision is made? Isn't that pretty rough on them, realistically?
Gladys, maybe I'm lucky, but both my daughters, Marianne and Kristen, who presently live in Nashville, Tennessee, were very supportive and have encouraged me for a number of years. And of course, my wife Betty has just been behind me all the way. And as a matter of fact, it was her urging that finally made me make the decision to give up everything else and to come to the seminary. And
mm-hmm.
So we sold our home and we're living in an apartment. And
that in itself is rather traumatic, though, I'm sure. But I guess that when you have the larger goal in mind, the other things recede into the background.
Well, that's true. And mm-hmm. we have not minded nor regretted any of those
mm-hmm.
decisions that we made.
Bob, how did your wife react?
My wife has been very supportive. She has encouraged it, in fact, all through the years, and I'm sure was perhaps even more happy than I when I finally made the decision. Our older son was 3 and a half at the time,
mm-hmm.
and it was a little bit of a traumatic situation for him because he was just developing his own set of friends,
mm-hmm.
and he lost his bedroom and he lost his Sunday
mm-hmm.
school class and his church, but he's made a beautiful adjustment. He has a lot of new friends, and he was going to school here on campus with at the Child of Nazareth preschool that Mrs. Hummel operates,
oh, yes. mm-hmm.
And that has made a big difference in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Our little one, of course, didn't know what was happening,
right,
and
right.
he takes everything in stride.
Mm-hmm. Well, then the other inevitable question, what about finances? You can't go to school, quit your job for nothing. What happens?
Well, we've had to, of course, use our savings to get Marianne to college in Nashville. And, of course, she still has one more year to go. Betty and I chose to sell our home, and we're presently living off of the equity that we had built up in our home. As far as tuition and cost of going to school, we have received help from sources of congregations and from friends. And so they're helping us as far as the school cost is concerned. But the regular day-to-day living we have to pay for out
mm-hmm.
of what we've been able to save.
This help that you are getting, did you know about this, or did this kind of come as a surprise?
Some of it has come as a real surprise, which points out to us that the Lord's looking out for us and that he will provide. So frankly, we're not really worried about it at
mm-hmm.
all.
Bob, do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, we've experienced much the same, that we don't worry about the finances. We know that the bills are going to keep right on coming, whether we worry about them or not. There are more important things to do. We received help from Florida Georgia District in the form of a grant. Also a scholarship from the Lutheran Women's Missionary League of the Florida Georgia District, and these are certainly two ready sources that are available to any of the colloquy students from their own district.
Mm-hmm.
We've received some modest help from friends and family, but and the seminary provides an educational grant based on need. But the day-to-day living expenses we are providing for ourselves. My working here at KFUO part-time has put some groceries on the table, and my wife works one day a week for a doctor, and that helps out too.
Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of just going sort of from day to day and just having a plan of action at the same time.
That's right.
Good. Well, let's talk about the colloquy program itself a little bit. Without going into a whole lot of detail, basically, how does it differ from the regular seminary training? Who wants to bite on that one?
Well, it takes the basic core of the
the MDiv program. The basic theological courses that all the men are taking, we take those courses without most of the electives. We're pretty well boxed into that program.
Mm-hmm.
And also then, the languages are not made a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So in a matter of 2 years, we are put through the core program and have received sufficient training to assure the church that we are now qualified for ministry as pastors.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole process then is under the supervision of and the direction of the colloquy board of synod.
Mm-hmm.
And the seminary has to assure the colloquy board step by step that we are indeed fulfilling the requirements to become pastors in the Lutheran Church Missouri mm-hmm. Synod.
Okay, several questions here. When you say 2 years, does that include summer school?
No, you would refer to two academic years, two full academic years.
Two full academic years.
And in many cases I have found, and certainly in my case, and I know in Merle's case, we're going through summer school. It's full steam ahead,
yeah.
No breaks, and it does tend to shorten it a bit, a quarter here and a quarter there, depending also, in my case now, bringing some graduate credit along. I have a master's from River Forest,
mm-hmm.
and I was allowed to transfer 10 hours of theology credits to the colloquy program here.
Mm-hmm.
So it did shorten my program to 15 months.
Mm-hmm.
Gladys, there is another difference, and that's with the vicarage.
Yes.
We have a deferred vicarage, which occurs after we finished our academic work. The normal students will take the vicarage after their second year and then complete their last year here on campus.
Mm-hmm.
After we've been approved, after being on vicarage, then we're ready to be ordained, and we do not have to come back to the seminary.
Mm-hmm. Well, is your vicarage as long as those of the MDiv students, or does that vary from person?
Well, the synodical handbook says up to a year.
Uh-huh.
It has been, in some cases, reduced, based primarily on the experience which the man already brings to that placement
mm-hmm.
And his performance in that vicarage. He is rated and evaluated just as all the other vicars are, and on the basis of that evaluation from his supervising pastor and in consultation with the seminary and the colloquy board, a decision can be made perhaps to shorten that vicarage.
Mm-hmm.
But we must count on up to a year.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, you finish all your classwork before you go out on vicarage.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah.
And am I correct? Now, this term, deferred vicarage, would one of you explain that? Why do we use that term, deferred vicarage?
I don't know why it was chosen. It was the term that I was introduced to through the synodical board, and also when I came on campus, the terminology is used. I would assume that it's called a deferred vicarage because, in our case, we do complete the classroom, the academic work first, and then are placed into the vicarage.
Mm-hmm.
It is the time of vicarage is deferred until the academic program is complete.
Oh, I see. Okay, now it makes sense to me. Uh-huh. You mentioned the colloquy board. Who are the people on the colloquy board? Are they some of our seminary professors?
To my knowledge, it would include both presidents of the seminaries plus the first vice president of the synod, mm-hmm. who is Dr. Weber.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Dr. Weber that I spoke to along with President Bowman and then our very capable advisor, Dr. Schultz, here on campus. Before
mm-hmm.
We made application.
I see. Is this also spelled out in the handbook?
Yes.
Who is on the colloquy board?
The synodical handbook has the details as to the membership of the board as well as the steps required in applying for the colloquy program.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If anyone is interested, and I would encourage any man who has a call from the Lord to do what we've done, to contact his district president first. And
that's step number one.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And consult with him first before he does anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, continuing then in chronological order, after a colloquy student has finished his vicarage, the reports are sent in to the seminary, I assume. What happens then with placement? Is there any difference there between the regular MDiv?
Yes, there is some difference. Normally, the colloquy candidate will be placed in the district of origin, is the term they use.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he will be placed by his district president into a congregation where there has been that need and that request. There are cases where a colloquy student is released by the district president, and in that case then, the normal placement procedure which the seminary uses comes into play, and there are interviews conducted here on campus, and through those interviews a profile is established which can be shared with various district presidents or all district presidents, so that the placement committee of the Council of Presidents then can make a selection.
Mm-hmm.
and a preliminary determination on where that candidate will be placed.
Uh-huh. Well, are you saying then that the colloquy board does not act as the placement committee?
Well, it should be, but the seminary, of course, is a good deal closer to the candidate
mm-hmm.
than the colloquy board. So the colloquy board, in conjunction with the seminary personnel, will accept the recommendation of the seminary as fulfilling the requirement in the handbook.
I see. Uh-huh.
Now, if you're not released by your district, though, and you follow the first step, then I believe that the congregation where you're placed, if they wish, can give you a call, and you can remain right there. And you have the, I guess, the choice to accept it.
Yes, well, that happens in the case of the alternate route, too. I've been informed that the congregation to which you are sent as a vicar can become your permanent placement. You can be ordained and installed there as the pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And that avoids another move,
right,
and upheaval of the family and so forth.
That's done quite often, I believe.
Yes, it is.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I can certainly understand why. Uh-huh. What part of the colloquy program have you found to be the most gratifying for you personally? Either one of you. Merlin, how about you biting on that one?
Well, I find that one of the things that I need the most are those in the exegetical department. I don't enjoy that kind of background as most of the teachers do.
Mm-hmm.
So in the areas of real exegesis, of real knowing what the scripture has to say, and for me to learn it so that I can pass it on to a congregation, that's the kind of thing that I need,
mm-hmm.
more than some of the practical courses. And I say that because of the extensive amount of work that I've had in the church as a layman. I feel that there's a great deal there that I already know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I lean toward the exegetical end, which is the area that I think I need the most.
Mm-hmm.
Bob, I don't know about you.
Well, in terms of the most gratifying part of the whole program, I would have to say just being able to make use of the resources and the facilities of the seminary, the library, the individual professors who will give you the time, who have their offices open for you or will set up office hours specially for you so that you can sit down and talk out either the problems or you can share some of the joys that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it has the gratifying part has been to be able to know that I'm a part of the seminary community with those resources available.
Mm-hmm. I would assume, too, I have no statistics, and probably neither one of you does either. I imagine that many of our colloquy pastors, just like other pastors, return for graduate school education. If there are areas in which they feel that they should have additional training, do either of you want to comment?
Well, Gladys, I would see that as a continuing requirement.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that any pastor owes it to his congregation to continue his study as best he can,
mm-hmm.
whatever it takes. Otherwise, I feel that we'll grow stale, and that's going to be reflected in our ministry.
Mm-hmm.
So I would certainly plan, and I believe most of the fellows that I know in the program plan to somehow or another get back here as often as they can,
mm-hmm.
and get some refresher courses to keep us alive and vital and keep things moving.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I would hope that would be among the goals that any pastor would set.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Incidentally, how many colloquy students do we have here on our campus?
I don't know the I was told at the beginning of this past academic year that there were about 32. I think we're probably pushing 50 to 60 in the coming year.
Exactly.
I understand there are still some coming.
Mm-hmm.
I know we certainly, Merlin, we certainly met a lot of new people
That's right.
Last 3 weeks, men coming on campus for the first time.
Well, it's very exciting to see, Gladys, because most of these men really bring something worthwhile to the seminary, which I think will be of invaluable use to our church.
Mm-hmm.
And with all the vacancies we got, I would encourage any man with any leanings at all toward getting into the ministry to make sure that he takes that first step and talks to his district president.
What is the status on these vacancies that you referred to? I've heard several different figures. You're talking, of course, about the congregations throughout our Senate which don't have a pastor. Is it something like 500, 600, 700?
I understand that it is approximately 700. That includes the United States, Canada, and Brazil.
Mm-hmm. Did these statistics have anything to say to you before you entered the colloquy program?
They didn't influence my decision, but they certainly have helped underscore to me the urgency that is in the church, and it makes it more important for me to complete my studies and to get out there into the parish where the need of a flock of people, a congregation, is so great because they have no shepherd.
Mm-hmm. And realizing God's and Christ's own command to go and teach all nations and to work while it is day. I'd like to quickly, before our time is up totally, ask you this question. Have you had to deal with any real personal hardships as a result of being in the colloquy program?
I guess if you want to include loss of sleep, that might be the only one that I know of. It was tough to have to sell our home and to live now off of the equity, so I guess I'm hoping that there'll be a parsonage available somewhere, because I have a feeling that most of the money that we've been able to accumulate will have to be spent while we're here.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'm trying to do some part-time work, it's just not possible to be able to earn enough to meet expenses.
Yeah.
And we've wrestled with that problem from time to time, too. There have been some extra medical bills in our family, and those kinds of things cause one to occasionally, I suppose, have some worries, but we generally try and set that aside because the Lord has so richly blessed us. We have found that help has come from unexpected places without us even asking for it, except to ask the Lord to help us with the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we find ourselves very much at ease so far as finances are concerned. Not that we have a lot,
mm-hmm.
but we know that the Lord continues to provide
mm-hmm.
what we need as we need it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been a real joy to work this through.
What I hear both of you saying is that while you look back sometimes, you never have regretted the decision that you've made.
No, Gladys.
And there's one other thing, Bob, I think you would agree, there's tremendous loyalty among the students. Everyone helps each other. I don't know of any case where if someone is in need that someone else has not come to the forefront and said, hey, let me help you out. And that's a marvelous, marvelous feeling.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sorry that our time is up. We could continue this for some time, I know. But thank you so much, Merlin Setmeyer and Bob Keeney, for being with us today and to tell us something about the colloquy program of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and your participation in it at Concordia Seminary. Thanks again.
Thanks, Larry.
We've been listening to Monday Memos from Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, with your host, Mrs. Gladys Soufflot.